Section 12 of The House Without a Key by Alda Biggers. This Legamus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Section 12. Tom Braid the Blackbirder. In Hallett's room at headquarters they found the captain of detectives seated grimly behind his desk, staring at two reluctant visitors. One of the visitors, Mr. Stephen Leatherby, stared back with a look of sullen defiance. Mrs. Arline Compton, late of Broadway and the Automat, was dabbing at her eyes with a tiny handkerchief. John Quincy perceived that she had carelessly allowed tears to play havoc with her makeup. "Hello, Charlie," said Hallett. "Mr. Winterslip, I'm glad you came along. As you may have heard, we've just pulled this young man off the Niagara. He seemed inclined to leave us. We found this in his pocket." He put into Chan's hand a time-yellowed page, obviously from Dan Winterslip's guest-book. John Quincy and Chan bent over it together. The inscription was written in an old-fashioned hand, and the ink was fading fast. It ran, "In Hawaii all things are perfect. None more so than hospitality I have enjoyed in this house. Joseph E. Gleason, 124 Little Bourke Street, Melbourne, Victoria." John Quincy turned away, shocked. No wonder that page had been ripped out. Evidently Mr. Gleason had not enjoyed the privilege of studying A. S. Hill's book on the principles of rhetoric. How could one thing be more perfect than another? "Before I take a statement from these people," Hallett was saying, "what's all this about a brooch?" John Quincy laid the piece of jewellery on the captain's desk. He explained that it had been given Mrs. Compton by Dan Winterslip, and told of its being discovered on the floor of the lanai. "When was it found?" demanded the captain, glaring his disapproval. "Most regrettable misunderstanding," put in Chan hastily. "Now completely wiped out. The littlest said sooner repairs are made. Mr. Winterslip has already tonight examined this woman."
"Oh, has he? Has he?"
Hallett turned angrily on John Quincy. "Just who is conducting this case?" "Well," began John Quincy uncomfortably, "it seemed best to the family."
"Damn the family!" Hallett exploded. "This affair is in my hands."
"Please," broke in Chan soothingly, "waste of time to winnow that out. Already I have boldness to offer suitable rebukes."
"Well, you talked with the woman, then," said Hallett.
"What did you get out of her?"
"Say, listen," put in Mrs. Compton. "I want to take back anything I told this bright-eyed boy."
"Lie to him, eh?" said Hallett.
"Why not? What right did he have to question me?"
Her voice became wheedling.
"I wouldn't lie to a cop," she added.
"You bet your life you wouldn't," Hallett remarked. "Not if you know what's good for you. However, I want to hear what you told this amateur detective. Sometimes lies are significant. Go on, Winterslip."
John Quincy was deeply annoyed. What was this mix-up he had let himself in for, anyhow? He had a notion to rise and with a cold blow leave the room. Something told him, however, that he couldn't get away with it. Very much on his dignity, he repeated the woman's story to him. Winterslip had come to her cottage the night before to make a final appeal for the brooch. On his promise to replace it with something else, she had given it up. He had taken it and left her at 9:30.
"That was the last she saw of him," finished John Quincy. Hallett smiled grimly. "So she told you, at any rate. But she admits she was lying. If you'd had the sense to leave this sort of thing to the proper people—" He wheeled on the woman. "You were lying, weren't you?" She nodded nonchalantly.
"In a way. Dan did leave my cottage at 9:30, or a little later, but I went with him to his house. Oh, it was perfectly proper. Steve went along."
"Oh, yes, Steve." Hallett glanced at Mr. Leatherby, who did not appear quite the ideal chaperone. "Now, young woman,
go back to the beginning, nothing but the truth.
"So help me," said Mrs. Compton. She attempted a devastating smile.
"I wouldn't lie to you, Captain. You know I wouldn't. I realize you're a big man out here, and—"
"Give me your story," cut in Hallett coldly.
"Sure. Dan stopped into my place for a chat last night about 9, and he found Mr. Leatherby there. He was jealous as sin, Dan was. Honest to God, I don't know why. Me and Steve are just pals, eh, Steve?"
"Pals, that's all," said Steve. "But anyhow, Dan flew off the handle, and we had one grand blow-up. I tried to explain Steve was just stopping over on his way to Australia, and Dan wants to know what's detaining him. So Steve tells about how he lost all his money at bridge on the boat coming out here.
'Will you move on?' says Dan, 'if I pay your passage?' And Steve answers he will, like a shot. Am I getting this straight, Steve?"
"Absolutely," approved Mr. Leatherby. "It's just as she says, Captain. Winterslip offered to loan me passage money. It was only a loan, and I agreed to sail on the Niagara tonight. He said he had little cash in his safe at the house, and invited Arline and me to go back with him."
"Which we did," said Arline. Dan opened the safe and took out a roll of bills. He peeled off $300. Didn't often see him in that frame of mind, but as I was saying, he'd give the money to Steve.
Then Steve begins to beef a little. 'Yes, you did, Steve,' and wants to know what he's going to do in Australia. Says he don't know a soul down there, and he'll just plain starve. Dan was sore at first. Then he laughs a nasty little laugh and goes over and tears that there page out of the guest book and gives it to Steve.
'Look him up, and tell him you're a friend of mine,' he says. 'Maybe he'll give you a job. The name is Gleason. I've disliked him for 20 years, though he don't know that.'"
"A dirty dig at me," Leatherby explained. "I took the loan and this Gleason's address, and we started to go. Winterslip said he wanted to talk to Arline, so I came away alone. That was about 10 o'clock.
"Where did you go?" Hallett asked.
"I went back to my hotel room. I had to pack."
"Back to your hotel? Can you prove it?"
Leatherby considered.
"I don't know. The boy at the desk may remember when I came in, though I didn't stop there for my key. I had it with me. Anyhow, I didn't see Winterslip after that. I just went ahead with my preparations to sail on the Niagara. And I must say you've got your nerve."
"Never mind that."
Hallett turned to the woman. "And after Leatherby left, what happened then?"
"Well, Dan started in on that brooch again," she said. "It made me sore, too. I never did like a tight wad. Besides, my nerves was all on edge. I'm funny that way. Rows get me all upset. I like everybody pleasant around me. He went on arguing, so finally I ripped off the brooch and threw it at him. And it rolled away under the table somewhere. Then he said he was sorry. And that was when he offered to replace it with something more up-to-date. The best money could buy. That was what he promised. Pretty soon we was friends again. Just as good friends as ever when I came away about 10:15. His last words was that we'd look around the jewelry stores this morning. I ask you, Captain, is it reasonable to think that I'd have anything to do with murdering a man who was in a buying mood like that?"
Hallett laughed. "So you left him at 10:15 and went home alone?"
"I did. When I saw him last he was alive and, well, I'll swear to that on a stack of Bibles as high as the Times building. Gee, don't I wish I was safe on Broadway tonight?"
Hallett thought for a moment.
"Well, we'll look into all this. You can both go. I'm not going to hold you at present, but I expect you both to remain in Honolulu until this affair has cleared up. And I advise you not to try any funny business. You've seen tonight what chance you've got to get away."
"Oh, that's all right." The woman stood, looking her relief. "We've got no reason to beat it, have we, Steve?"
"None in the world," agreed Steve. His factitious manner returned.
"Speaking for myself," he added, "Innocent is my middle name. Good night, all. said Mrs. Compton, and they went out.
Hallett sat staring at the brooch.
"Pretty straight story," he remarked, looking at Chan.
"Nice and neat," grinned the Chinese man.
"If true."
Hallett shrugged his shoulders.
"Well, for the present, I am willing to believe it." He turned to John Quincy.
"Now, Mr. Winterslip,"
he said severely,
"I want it understood that any other evidence your family it digs up—"
"Oh, that's all right," interrupted the boy. "We'll turn it over at once. I've already given to Chan the newspaper my cousin was reading that night he wrote the letter to Roger Winterslip."
Chan took the paper from his pocket.
"Such a busy evening," he explained. "The journal was obscure in my mind. Thanks for the recollection." He called to the chief's attention the mutilated corner.
"Look into that," said Hallett.
"Before sleeping," promised Chan.
"Mr. Winterslip, we pursue similar paths. The honour of your company in my humble vehicle would pleasure me deeply." Once in the car on the deserted street, he spoke again. "The page ripped from guest book, the brooch lying silent on floor. Both are now followed into presence of immovable stone wall. We sway about, look for another path."
"Then you think those two were telling the truth?" John Quincy asked.
"As to that, I do not venture to remark," Chan replied.
"How about those psychic powers?" inquired John Quincy.
Chan smiled. "Psychic powers somewhat drowsy just now," he admitted. "Need prodding into wakefulness."
"Look here," said John Quincy. "There's no need for you to take me out to Waikiki. Just drop me on King Street and I'll get a trolley."
"Making humble suggestion," Chan replied. "Is it not possible you will accompany me to newspaper rooms where we set out on different paths?"
John Quincy looked at his watch. It was 11:10.
"I'll be glad to," he said.
Chan beamed with pleasure.
"Greatly honoured by your friendly manner," he remarked. He turned into a side street. "Newspaper of this nature burst out at evening. Very quiet now. Somebody may loiter in rumours if we have happy luck."
They had just that, for the building of the Evening Journal was open, and in the city room an elderly man with a green shade over his eyes hammered on a typewriter.
"Hello, Charlie," he said cordially.
"Hello, Pete. Mr. Winterslip of Boston. I have all the honour to present this Pete Maybury. For many years he explored waterfront, ferreting for whatever news are hiding there."
The elderly man rose and removed his eyeshade, revealing a pleasant twinkle. He was evidently interested to meet a Winterslip.
"We pursue," continued Chan, "one copy of paper marked June 16, present year. If you have no inclination for objecting."
Maybury laughed.
"Go to it, Charlie. You know where the files are."
Chan bowed and disappeared.
"Your first appearance out here, Mr. Winterslip?" inquired the newspaper man.
John Quincy nodded.
"I've only just got here," he said, "but I can see it's a rather intriguing place."
"You've said it," smiled Maybury. 46 years ago I came out from Portsmouth, New Hampshire, to visit relatives. I've been in the newspaper game here ever since, most of the time on the waterfront. There's a life work for you."
"You must have seen some changes," remarked John Quincy inanely.
Maybury nodded.
"For the worse. I knew Honolulu in the glamorous days of its isolation, and I've watched it fade into an 8th carbon copy of Babbittsville, USA. The waterfront's just a waterfront now. But once, my boy, once it oozed romance at every pore."
Chan returned carrying a paper.
"Much to be thankful for," he said to Maybury. "Your kindness are quite overwhelming."
"Anything doing?" asked Maybury eagerly.
Chan shook his head.
"Presently speaking, no. Our emotions just now must be blackly clouded in secrecy."
"Well," said the reporter, "when it comes time to roll them clouds away, don't forget me." "Impossibility," protested Chan. "Good night." They left Maybury bending over his typewriter, and at Chan's suggestion went to the All-American restaurant, where he ordered 2 cups of "Your Unspeakable Coffee." While they waited to be served, he spread out on the table his complete copy of the newspaper, and laying the torn page on its counterpart, carefully removed the upper right-hand corner. "The missing fragment," he explained. For a time he studied it thoughtfully, and finally shook his head. "I apprehend nothing to startle," he admitted. He handed it across the table. "If you will condescend greatly." John Quincy took the bit of newspaper. On one side was the advertisement of a Japanese dealer in skirtings who wrote his own publicity. Anyone might carry off, he said, 6 yards for the price of 5. John Quincy laughed aloud. "Ah," said Chan, "you are by rights mirthful. Kikuchi, purveyor of skirting cloth, seize on grand English language and make it into a jumble. On that side are nothing to detain us, but humbly hinting you reverse the fragment." John Quincy reversed it. The other side was a part of the shipping page. He read it carefully. News of sailings and arrivals. There would be places for 5 passengers to the Orient on the Shinyomaru, leaving Wednesday. The Wilhelmina was 640 miles east of Makapu Point, the brig Mary Jane from the treaty ports. John Quincy started and caught his breath. A small item in tiny print had met his eye. "Among the passengers who will arrive here on the Sonoma from Australia a week from Saturday are Mr. and Mrs. Thomas McCann Braid of Calcutta." John Quincy sat staring at the unwashed window of the All-American restaurant. His mind went back to the deck of the President Tyler, to a lean old missionary telling a tale of a bright morning on Apiang, a grave under a palm tree. "Mr. and Mrs. Thomas McCambraid of Calcutta." He heard again the missionary's high-pitched voice. "A callous root, a pirate and adventurer. Tom Braid, the blackbirder." But Braid had been buried in a long pine box on Appian. Even at the crossroads of the Pacific, his path and that of Dan Winterslip could hardly have crossed again. The waiter brought the coffee. Chan said nothing, watching John Quincy closely. Finally he spoke. "You have much to tell me." John Quincy looked around quickly. He had forgotten Chan's presence. His dilemma was acute. Must he here, in this soiled restaurant in a far town, reveal to this man that ancient blot on the Winterslip name? What would Aunt Minerva say? Well, only a short time ago she had remarked that she was resolved to have no more secrets from the police. However, there was family pride. John Quince's eyes fell on the Japanese waiter. What were those lines from the Mikado? But family pride must be denied and mortified and set aside. The boy smiled. "Yes, Charlie," he admitted, "I have much to tell you. And over the unspeakable coffee of the All-American restaurant," he repeated to the detective the story the Reverend Frank Upton had told on the President Tyler. Chan beamed. "Now," he cried, "we arrive in the neighborhood of something. Braid the Blackbirder, master maid of Shiloh boat, on which Mr. Dan Winterslip, our first officer." "But Braid was buried on Appian," protested John Quincy. "Yes, indeed. And who saw him, pardon me? Was it then an unsealed box? Oh, no." Chan's eyes were dancing. "Please recollect something more. The strong box of Ohio wood. Initials on it are T.M.B. Mysteries yet, but we move, we advance." "I guess we do," admitted John Quincy. "This much we grasp," Chan continued. "Dan Winterslip reposed for quiet hour on Lanai, in peaceful reading. This news assault his eye. He now leaps up, paces about, flees to dock to send letter requesting, please, the Ohio wood box must be buried deep in Pacific. Why?" Fumbling in his pocket, Chan took out a sheaf of papers, evidently lists of steamer arrivals. On Saturday just gone by, the Sonoma make this port. Among passengers, yes, yes, Thomas McCann Braid, an honourable wife, Calcutta. It is here inscribed they arrive to stay, not being present when Sonoma persist on journey. On the night of Monday, Mr. Dan Winterslip are foully slain, which makes Mr. Braid an important person to locate, said John Quincy. How very true. But the hurry are not intense. No boat sailing now. Before sleeping I will investigate downtown hotels, Waikiki tomorrow. Where are you, Mr. Braid? Chan seized the check. No, pardon me. The honour of paying for this poison-tasting beverage must be mine. Out in the street he indicated an approaching trolley. It bears imprint of your destination, he pointed out. You will require sleep. We meet tomorrow. Congratulations on most fruitful evening. Once more John Quincy was on a Waikiki car. Wary but thrilled, he took out his pipe and, filling it, lighted up. What a day! He seemed to have lived a lifetime since he landed that very morning. He perceived that his smoke was blowing in the face of a tired little Japanese woman beside him. Pardon me, he remarked, and knocking the pipe against the side rail, put it into his pocket. The woman stared at him in meek, startled wonder. No one had ever asked her pardon before. On the seat behind John Quincy, a group of Hawaiian boys with yellow leis about their necks twanged on steel guitars and sang a plaintive love song. The trolley rattled on through the fragrant night. Above the clatter of the wheels, the music rose with a sweet intensity. John Quincy leaned back and closed his eyes. A clock struck the hour of midnight. Another day, Wednesday. It flashed through his mind that today his firm in Boston would offer that preferred stock for the shoe people in Lynn. Would the issue be oversubscribed? No matter. Here he was, out in the middle of the Pacific on a trolley car. Behind him brown-skinned boys were singing a melancholy love song of long ago, and the moon was shining on crimson poinciana trees. And somewhere on this tiny island a man named Thomas McCann Braid slept under a mosquito netting, or lay awake, perhaps, thinking of Dan Winterslip. End of section 12.